This morning, America's first news starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Trump slams the Times. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. It is Monday, August 20th. Glad you could be with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
President Trump is ripping a report he says wasn't fully aware of the extent of the cooperation that White House counsel Don McGahn was providing the Mueller investigation.
Catholics attending Mass in Pennsylvania in the wake of a shocking grand jury report about sex abuse by priests say they're not giving up on their faith.
The deadly Ferguson fire, which burned nearly 100,000 acres near Yosemite National Park, has been 100% contained.
And how researchers are trying to take the pain out of what will soon be the world's longest flight.
Airplanes have longer and longer range, and airlines are taking advantage of that to launch longer and longer flights. And so the concern is that much time in what is really a pretty harsh environment, very dry, different altitude pressure, it takes a toll on the human body.
Wall Street Journal travel writer Scott McCartney on the science involved with the newest long-haul flights. He's here in about 20 minutes. President Trump is comparing the special counsel's investigation of Russian interference in the U.S. elections to McCarthyism of the 1950s. In addition, the president is denying that his own lawyer's extensive cooperation with the probe invited comparisons to the Watergate scandal. Separately, Rudy Giuliani, Mr. Trump's lawyer, was on NBC's Meet the Press discussing the potential of Mr. Trump testifying.
I'm not going to be rushed into having him testify so that he gets trapped into perjury. And when you tell me that, you know, he should testify because he's going to tell the truth and he shouldn't worry, well, that's so silly because it's somebody's version of the truth, not the truth.
Mr. Trump, meanwhile, took to Twitter yesterday to respond to news reports that White House counsel Don McGahn sat for lengthy interviews with special counsel investigators. The president said he told Mr. McGahn and other staff to fully cooperate and rejected the notion by the New York Times that he was unaware of the extent of the cooperation or that Mr. McGahn was sharing damning information. It was not an easy weekend for churchgoers, especially in Pennsylvania. It was the first time many attended Mass since a grand jury report earlier in the week detailed widespread sexual abuse by hundreds of priests there. Nearly 200 parishioners filled almost all the pews for Saturday's Mass at St. Patrick's Church in York, Pennsylvania, where six priests who at one time worked in that parish are accused of sexually abusing children. Kathy Morris, a retired steelworker and St. Patrick's parishioner for over 15 years, says she can't talk about it without crying. Reporter Jack Jenkins is with Religion News Service.
No matter what Pope Francis does, what Pope Francis says, I think for a lot of victims, unless there is action behind those words, unless there is drastic, dramatic, and sustained action from the top of the church, they're not going to be satisfied.
Few people attended the 9 a.m. service at St. Margaret Mary in Harrisburg, where the report accuses Reverend Richard Barry of abusing boys in the 1980s. Reuters says the parking lot was nearly empty. The New York Times is reporting that federal authorities investigating President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, for bank and tax fraud have zeroed in on well over $20 million in loans obtained by taxi businesses that he and his family own. We get more from this morning's Dave Duncan.
The Times says the bank loans under scrutiny came from two financial institutions that have catered to the taxi industry, Sterling National Bank and the Melrose Credit Union. Federal investigators in New York are seeking to determine whether Mr. Cohen misrepresented the value of his assets to obtain the giant loans. They are also examining how he handled the income from his taxi medallions and whether he failed to report it to the IRS. Gordon?
Thanks, Dave. Meanwhile, investigators are also examining whether Mr. Cohen violated campaign finance or other laws by helping to arrange financial deals to secure the silence of women who said they had affairs with Mr. Trump. The Times says prosecutors are considering filing charges by the end of this month. It's 11 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Welcome into Monday. Question for you. Which would you prefer, economic authoritarianism or domineering socialism? This might sound like an Econ 101 thought experiment, but in reality, it's the choice being offered American voters by the nation's two major political parties. Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman says if you thought Republicans and Democrats mainly differed on the matter of how best to distribute the spoils of free market capitalism, you're stuck in the 1990s. Rick, the headline says both parties are rejecting capitalism.
Well, I write the headlines, but I don't make up the stories. This is what's really going on. Well, we saw a kind of a pro-business approach from President Trump last year, and that culminated, I think, in the tax cuts. You know, he basically said, let's give businesses more of their own money and let them do what they want with it, and individual taxpayers too. But this year, we've seen really a remarkable amount of intervention in the economy by Trump. That's happening through the tariffs, of course, where he's basically saying, you know, I like the steel and aluminum industries, so I'm going to put tariffs on imports to protect those industries. But I guess I don't really like all the consumers of steel and aluminum, the auto companies, the appliance makers. So too bad. They're just going to have to pay more. And if they want to pass the costs on to consumers, fine with me. I mean, that's the real impact of his tariffs. He's having, you know, any company that tries to run its business in a way that Trump doesn't approve of, he goes after them. Harley Davidson. He is trying to stop this merger still between AT&T and Time Warner, which, you know, antitrust experts have said, look, this really is not going to harm consumers at all. It makes sense for these companies to do this and so on. So Trump is really just intervening in the economy in a kind of a haphazard way based on whatever seems to stir him at the moment.
I knew there were some socialists running for office, but I didn't realize till I read your story that there are 42 of them seeking office.
Right.
What does that mean for this whole idea of perhaps Medicare for all, which I thought was funny yet made me cry when you said, if you like the way the post office is run, you'll love Medicare for all.
I'm sorry I made you cry, Gordon. not what I intend. So I think, first of all, there's a definitional issue here. You know, I studied economics in college, and when I think of socialism, and I think when economists think of socialism, we think of textbook socialism, which is public ownership of all property. So, the state owns industry and the state decides how industry should run, and there's no such thing as private property. But I think there's some vagueness on what socialism means. And to some people, I think it just means a wider safety net and more government safety net programs whereas we would still have private industry. But I think if that's what you believe in, come up with a better word than socialism. Call it something else. Call it Sandersism or something else, because socialism has pretty bad connotations. I mean, there have been socialist governments. Venezuela, arguably, is a socialist government, and it's in a complete collapse. And basically, every attempt to have a socialist economy, a real socialist economy, has failed simply because the government is, you know, radically inefficient. And it just depresses living standards. So, you know, we can have a legitimate conversation about should we have more generous safety net systems and should we fix some of the other problems we have in our economy, such as, income inequality is too wide. But socialism is not the answer.
Wow. We're speaking with Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman. He's written a piece entitled "Both Political Parties Are Rejecting Capitalism." You posed the question in your story. Is there an answer to it about where are the pragmatic centrists?
That's correct. Yeah, they are not in either political party, apparently. Republicans, more than 80% of Republicans support President Trump, including, you know, what he's doing in interfering with the economy through tariffs and trade wars and things like that. Democrats are getting behind the Medicare for All idea and other things like this. But on the other hand, the biggest block of voters are now independents who do not affiliate themselves with either party. That's around 40% of the electorate. Democrats are around 30% of the electorate, and then Republicans are around 25%. Those numbers change a little bit, but more people now say that they are independents than say they belong to either of these political parties, which I think just tells you people are disgusted with the political system that as it exists in the country right now.
Thanks, Rick. Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman, who's based in New York. It's 20 minutes after the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koschenka is here with more of America's First News.
Gordon, President Trump insists that the White House counsel isn't a rat like the Watergate-era White House attorney who turned on Richard Nixon, and he is blasting the ongoing Russia investigation as McCarthyism. In a series of angry tweets yesterday, Trump denounced a New York Times story that his White House counsel, Don McGahn, has been cooperating extensively with a special counsel team investigating Russian election meddling and potential collusion with Trump's Republican campaign. Meanwhile, Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani appeared on NBC to explain why he has some reservations about Trump sitting for an interview with special counsel Robert Mueller.
We have a credibility gap between the two of them. You got to select one or the other. Now, who do you think Mueller's going to select? One of his best friends, Comey, or the president who he has been carrying on a completely wild, crazy, unorthodox investigation?
Federal investigators have locked in on more than $20 million in loans to taxi businesses owned by Michael Cohen and his family as part of their probe into whether the former longtime personal lawyer for President Trump committed bank and tax fraud crimes and campaign finance violations. The New York Times reports that prosecutors are considering filing charges against Cohen by the end of this month. Dozens of elderly South Koreans crossed the heavily fortified border into North Korea today for heart-wrenching meetings with relatives most haven't seen since they were separated by the turmoil of the Korean War. The week-long event at a North Korean resort comes as the rival Koreas boost reconciliation efforts amid a diplomatic push to resolve a standoff over North Korea's drive for a nuclear weapons program. It was all gold for Simone Biles. In the second meet of her comeback, the gymnast won her record fifth U.S. all-around title and swept the four apparatus titles, combining scores from Friday and yesterday at TD Garden in Boston. She spoke with NBC.
It feels really special, especially coming back after such a long break and being able to keep up with the other girls, and it feels great.
The four-time Rio Olympic gold medalist becomes the first woman to win all five golds at the National Gymnastics Championship since Dominique Dawes in 1994.
You can't be that good. That's not fair. She takes a break, comes back, dominates.
Yeah, good stuff.
Thanks, Jen. 23 minutes after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Airlines and scientists are studying the effects of spending 20 hours or more in an arid cabin at high altitude. That's because Singapore Airlines is prepping for its 9,500-mile nonstop trips between Newark, New Jersey, and Singapore, which will be the longest flights in the world when they launch in October. Wall Street Journal travel writer Scott McCartney says long-haul carriers like Singapore and Qantas are beginning to change everything from food service to cabin lighting. Scott, what do we have?
Yeah, well, airplanes have longer and longer range, and airlines are taking advantage of that to launch longer and longer flights. So you can fly point to point, bypass a hub, but that creates a situation where you're in the air for 18, 20, someday even 22 hours straight. And so the concern is that that much time in what is really a pretty harsh environment, very dry, different altitude pressure, it takes a toll on the human body. And so that's what's being studied, and how to combat that. What kind of food should you serve? What should there be exercise on the airplane? What are the sleep patterns that will work best? It's really sort of complicated wellness stuff. And so both Singapore and Qantas are really diving into this with experts.
Well, we're speaking with Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney. His piece is called The Science Behind the World's Longest Flights. All right, so what are they doing? What are they experimenting with?
So Singapore, interestingly, is working with Canyon Ranch, the spa in Tucson, Arizona. They also have locations in Lenox, Mass, and Las Vegas, and well-known brand. And, you know, the Canyon Ranch people are experts in what food does to the body. The Singapore Airlines people are experts in what the airplane does to food, but also what the airplane does to the body. So they're working together, and it turns out that in a really dry, harsh environment, obviously you need to hydrate, and so there are certain foods that can help with that. One example I thought was fascinating, that they will take a riced cauliflower, mix it with turmeric, which has anti-inflammatory powers, but make it look like mashed potatoes. So instead of serving you a heavy carb, They'll serve you something light, but it was something that is actually mostly water, and that'll help hydrate. The lightness of the meal is also important. You want to keep your blood sugar levels pretty stable on an airplane, so you don't want to do the heavy meal and fall asleep kind of routine. It turns out that we've all been doing it wrong for a long time.
Hey, Scott, that is Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney, who's based in Dallas. Again, Singapore Airlines prepping for a 9,500-mile nonstop trip between Newark, New Jersey, and Singapore. Will be one of the longest flights in the world when it launches in October. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. Like us on Facebook or send us an email. This Morning at CompassMediaNetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us on this Monday, August 20th. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka, some of our top stories and headlines. Trump slams a New York Times report about the White House counsel's cooperation with Mueller's probe. New security measures face students at Santa Fe High School today. First day of classes for them since a shooter killed 10 people there in May. MTV hosts its annual Video Music Awards tonight. First Lady attends a cyberbullying summit today. Deadly Ferguson fire outside Yosemite declared 100% contained. And a heart-stopping video of a father and son escaping the flames of a Montana wildfire. That story in about 20 minutes. It's time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. Amazon isn't just a Seattle company anymore, and a visit to its offices in Boston explains why. More from Elizabeth Weiss, tech writer at USA Today, who visited the Amazon office in Boston. Elizabeth, I didn't realize how widespread Amazon is.
So we knew that Amazon had what it calls tech hubs, which is offices around North America where they have computer scientists, engineers, I mean, white-collar workers. These aren't folks who work in fulfillment centers. And we knew that they had a bunch of offices around, but when I actually got a list of all of them, there's 17 of them, and it turns out 28% of their North American corporate workers, and Amazon makes a distinction between corporate workers, which is basically white-collar workers, and fulfillment center, the folks who work in the warehouses. 28% of those jobs are not in Seattle anymore, and this is before they build their second headquarters.
Wow. Why is that? Why are they seemingly so spread out?
Well, you know, it's that they are so ravenous for tech talent. They cannot hire enough in Seattle, and so they have, to a certain extent, been forced to open offices where the tech talent is. For example, they're in Boston because, you know, MIT and Northeastern, great schools pumping out PhDs in these fields. Pittsburgh, which is where Carnegie Mellon is, which pumps out a ton of people. It's also where there's just a big constellation of talent in a certain area. New York, not surprisingly, is where all the Amazon fashion people work. Los Angeles is where all the people who work for Amazon Prime Video and create those shows work. But then there's interesting ones like Minneapolis has there's a couple of hundred people working for Amazon there, but it's because Target's there and it's a center for retail excellence.
Wow. What's that Boston office like? I know you paid a visit.
Oh, you know, you walk in and you feel like you're in Silicon Valley. It's funny. It is. It's all exposed brick and kind of hip, groovy, cool, open spaces. Lots of young people hunched over computers, tapping away on their laptops. Some interesting, you know, kind of fun stuff about the fact that it's Amazon, so, you know, the walls look like shipping containers, and there's this one kind of fun wall divider that's made up of the rolling metal cylinders that they use on their conveyor belts, only it's vertical, so you can kind of run your hand across it. But it just feels like walking into Silicon Valley.
Wow. We're speaking with USA Today technology writer Elizabeth Weiss. She's written a piece entitled "Amazon is no longer a Seattle company." How about overseas?
So they also have a bunch of tech hubs overseas. It's actually 16, 17 if you include London, which has also just got some governmental workers. And those tend not to be quite as big, but it's interesting. I was talking to the guy who is in charge of making Alexa able to speak. He's actually based in Boston. And he said, yeah, I've got a whole team in Gdansk, Poland, because it turns out there was one guy at the university there who was apparently, you know, this incredible machine translation guy. And they hired him, and he said, I don't want to leave. And so they said, fine, we'll start an office there. And they found that once they start an office someplace, people even who aren't in that specific group want to go there.
So Elizabeth Weiss, tech writer at USA Today. Amazon's Boston hub is growing, by the way. Executives predict its tech and managerial workers will increase from 1,200 to 3,200 in the next 5 years. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us. Welcome into Monday. Strength and conditioning coaches in college football have evolved from handy helpers in the gym to overlords of a season outside the season. Off-season workouts. It's their domain in weight rooms shielded even from the view of head coaches that is increasingly under scrutiny after a series of player deaths and hospitalizations following grueling workouts. The most recent incident involved the death of 19-year-old Jordan McNair at the University of Maryland in June. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman says these strength and conditioning coaches have become among the most highly paid and influential on staffs. Rachel, what have you found?
What's happened is strength and conditioning coaches, particularly who work for football programs, have really risen in terms of their prominence and the influence they have on programs. This has become an issue in part because of the situation at Maryland, where a player died after a pretty extreme workout in June. The strength and conditioning coach there has since resigned. There were allegations that he was really overly harsh with players and maybe had some approaches that were a bit too extreme. And so what we did in the story is just look at the phenomenon of the strength coach and look at some of the aspects that have led to its rise.
Like what? What'd you find?
Well, there were some rule changes in the early 90s and the early 2000s that really increased their influence. For instance, practice time was limited in the early 90s for college football teams. So coaches really couldn't coach players as much as they would like. But strength coaches were written as an exception, so they don't count as technically as coaches. So players can work out with them on a quote-unquote voluntary basis, you know, as much as they want. Year-round in the summer when coaches are not allowed to coach them, the strength coaches can. So they can be with them in the weight room and actually design workout programs for them. And this has given strength coaches really a ton of influence. They are basically the de facto coaches in the summer. And you know, they're doing things like helping players shed weight or gain weight, which on a football team that only has, you know, when a player only has 4 or 5 years to compete is really critical.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. She's written a piece entitled "Strength Coaches in College Football Have Become Strongmen," is largely because of this newfound influence that they have. You get the sense, or is anybody suggesting that these strength coaches need regulations of their own?
Yes, I think there is more of a cry from some from college sports leaders that maybe the standards for certification should increase. The NCAA has really sort of stepped back and not exerted a lot of influence in this area, a few years ago, they required these coaches to have some sort of nationally recognized certification, but, you know, that really farms out the responsibility to things like weightlifting organizations and strength coach organizations to create their own standards. So it's still not a universal standard for how much training these guys need to have. And so I think there is a growing movement for there to be, you know, more training and some sort of more standardized level of training for these coaches. And I should say, you know, some of them have quite a bit of training. Some have, you know, undergraduate, masters, even PhDs in exercise science, things like that. So some of them, you know, have been in their jobs for years and have a lot of qualifications. Others, not so much.
Wow. There was one line in your story that really jumped out, too, that seems to capture so much of this. You said, in a famously violent sport, violence is not the leading cause of death. And that's why the focus is on these strength guys.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, and what we're talking about there is a study that just basically logged the causes of death of players while they're still in college. As we know, there can be long-term ill effects from football that can cause death in later years. But in terms of players who died in college, there were more players who have died in training and sort of off-season workout and conditioning type activities than in, you know, the head-on-head, very violent collisions on the field that we hear so much about, which is a little alarming when you think about it because, you know, the training aspect is where you have a lot more control. You know, on the field, often you can't exactly control how you're colliding with another player, but in training, you can. You can, you know, limit how much you're working out or how much weight you're lifting, things like that, what the kind of weather you're working out in for long periods. So that is pretty alarming that some of these deaths certainly are preventable.
It's Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username @ThisMorningShow. If you like some cynicism and sarcasm, you can follow me directly on Twitter with the username @GordonDeal. It is 12 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you could spend some time with us. It is 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is back with more of America's First News.
Gordon, President Trump is lashing out again at Special Counsel Robert Mueller, comparing his investigation of Russian interference in the U.S. elections to McCarthyism of the 1950s, and denying that his own lawyer's extensive cooperation with the probe invited comparisons to the Watergate scandal. On Twitter yesterday, Trump responded to reports that White House counsel Don McGahn sat for lengthy interviews with special counsel investigators. Meanwhile, Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani explained to NBC what that 2016 Trump Tower meeting was about.
The meeting was originally for the purpose of getting information about Clinton.
Giuliani also expressed concern about the possibility the special counsel's investigation could set a perjury trap for the president. A surge in calls to a clergy abuse hotline in Pennsylvania is breathing new life into a vast investigation of predator priests and Roman Catholic church leaders accused of protecting them. The hotline has drawn more than 300 calls since the release of a grand jury report last week claiming church leaders protected hundreds of accused priests at the expense of more than 1,000 abuse victims. Pittsburgh Bishop David Zubik, one of the church leaders discussed in the report, appeared on ABC yesterday.
We have followed every single step that we needed to follow to be responsible in our response to the victims.
The redacted report detailed the latest in a decades-long series of claims of abuse and protection leveled against the church. India's southern state of Kerala may get some much-needed relief in the coming days as the forecast shows less rain for the area that has been dealing with deadly monsoon floods for more than a week. More than 350 people have died and at least 800,000 others have been displaced, but there are fears the number of dead could increase as rescue and recovery efforts continue. Here's an incredible tale of resolve and rescue. A British woman was pulled out of the Adriatic Sea yesterday after falling off a cruise ship and treading water for 10 hours. The woman was on the Norwegian Star near Croatia when she fell overboard. The Coast Guard was notified and a search and rescue operation ensued. They found the 46-year-old about 10 hours later and plucked her out of the Adriatic. She's in stable condition after getting treatment.
That's unbelievable. First, how do you fall off a cruise ship?
I don't know.
I don't understand how this happens sometimes.
I don't either. She said she was on the back of the... I don't know.
Posing for, you know, for pictures.
And then if you are drinking, you wouldn't think that you would be able to survive 10 hours treading water.
Well,
so Hopefully that's not the situation.
Plus the shock of the fall.
I know.
I mean, it's not like some 6-foot drop like off a high diving board or something.
Yeah, she's okay. Pretty amazing.
Cow. Thank you, Jen. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Heart-stopping cell phone video has captured the terrifying moments of a father and son barely escaping with their lives after driving through a forest fire at Glacier National Park in Montana. Justin Bilton and his 70-year-old father Charlie were backpacking and had set up camp when a lightning storm struck. It caused the blaze that turned into the Howe Ridge Fire. It's burned thousands of acres along Lake McDonald. The pair realized they needed to get out and hopped into their rental car, but soon they had driven into and were surrounded by intense flames.
Easy, easy, can't see. Just go easy now. Easy.
Dad, the car is heating up. It's going to explode. Oh, Jesus, God, help us.
They had to reverse through the fire to get back to the trailhead and down to the lake. They abandoned their car, which later succumbed to the flames. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.